So, Danny, am I right? Your father was in the hospitality business. He was an entrepreneur as well, right?
He was, and I remember when I first opened Union Square Cafe. Back then, everybody wore ties all the time. He said, you always need to dress at least as well as your best-dressed guest.
I want the audio record to reflect that I am wearing a tie and you are not.
The other piece of advice he gave me was, he said, now, as a restaurateur, you need to make sure to shake everyone's hand on the way into the men's room, and no one's hand on the way out.
From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. You've probably heard a stat along these lines. 60% of restaurants fail within the first year. 80% fail in the first 5 years, which makes my guest today, Danny Meyer, pretty incredible. Because for the past 30 years, he has opened up one successful restaurant after another. From high-end, iconic New York spots like Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, and 11 Madison Park, to the barbecue joint Blue Smoke. Then, of course, there's the ever-expanding burger chain Shake Shack, which Danny took public 2 years ago, and many, many more. Along the way, Danny has broken a lot of the rules of the industry. For instance, he doesn't believe the customer should come first. And last year, he made big news when he eliminated tipping at many of his restaurants. So, how has this guy managed to succeed where so many others have failed? I interviewed Danny live on stage at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York. So before we get into the weightiest issues I want to cover, can we just nerd out on burgers? I'm a fan of Shake Shack. And for folks who don't know, or the listeners who are elsewhere in the country and may not have been exposed, it's in the vein of Five Guys, Smash Burger, In-N-Out Burger. You got the pressed burger patty, you get the Maillard reaction, it's crispy on the outside, it's on the potato bun with American cheese and lettuce and tomato and Shack sauce, which is a proprietary blend of ketchup, mustard, mayo, pickles, and a few other magical items, I'm sure.
Who gave you the recipe?
Can you describe to me your perfect bite of a Shack burger?
You want to get that caramelization that happens with the exterior. You want there just to be the faintest amount of pink on the inside, just the faintest amount. The reason that we made the Shack burger the size that it is, whereby not only could you cook it in under 6 minutes, but secondly, we wanted to come up with a doneness where it just wouldn't really matter, that it would be juicy and delicious even if we cooked everyone exactly the same way. So for me, the perfect Shack burger experience, it happens when we just get the caramelization right, we get the temperature right, we get the seasoning right.
And if you could only take one more bite of a Shack burger in your life, would it be from the crispy perimeter or from the juicy center?
You meant it when you said, let's geek out over burgers here. You know what? I've got such a big bite, I'd get both no matter what. I'm not going to put my little teeth on the edge and be dainty about this thing.
All right.
You got to get it all together.
Another burger nerd question for you, if I may.
Keep going.
When you get a Shake Shack burger, it's in that sort of little wax paper bag. And I note that the bun is not completely sliced in two. It is an unsevered or hinged bun. You seem like a man who did that on purpose. Tell me why you think that makes for a better burger.
When we created the burger at Shake Shack was to say, how can you take something that simple and could you possibly improve upon it? And so you have all these questions. You have questions like, what kind of bun are you going to use? And we came up with the idea of the Martin's potato bun, which I had used from the supermarket at home.
Yeah.
And loved it.
It's like the secret. If you want to cook a burger at home, if you put it on a Martin's potato roll, like everyone's going to think you're the most amazing chef.
And as far as why is the bun hinged, I guess just to be one more thing that catches all those juices as you're eating it.
Look, we could also talk for a long time about whether or not the cheese should be on the bottom of the burger, but I think we'll move on.
Thank you.
I know you get a lot of questions about tipping, and there's so many social dynamics at play with tipping, and you famously eliminated tipping at one of your restaurants and now more and more of your restaurants. Let's begin at the beginning. What is the problem with tipping?
Tipping is, it's actually one of the biggest hoaxes ever pulled on an entire culture, the American culture. Tipping started in our country right after the Civil War. And the restaurant industry, as well as the Pullman train car industry, successfully petitioned the United States government to make a dispensation for our industries that we would not pay our servers, but it wasn't considered slavery because we would ask our customers to pay tips, and therefore no one could say that they were being enslaved. And, you know, no surprise, but most of the people who were working in service professional jobs in restaurants and in Pullman train cars were African American. That's the history of how it started in this country. You don't see it in Asia. You don't see it primarily in most European countries. But that's what it was. And it created a completely false economy so that when you see a menu price at a restaurant, you know, and I know, that it includes the cost of the food, the cost of the linen, the rent, but it doesn't include the service. And here's what finally moved me to my own tipping point a year ago. What is a tip? It's a multiplier of menu pricing. And as menu prices have gone up, so too has the multiplier. Over the course of my career, which is now 31 years, tipped employees, happily for them, are making about 300% of what they were making 31 years ago. During that same 31-year period, everyone in the kitchen, the dishwasher, non-tip eligible employees have seen their hourly income go up about 20%. 20%.
Let's face it, there's also a racial dynamic at play here, not only in the origins of tipping, but we know that on average, of course there are exceptions, but on average, when you go, as you go from the front of the house of a restaurant to the back of a house of a restaurant, the complexion tends to get darker. And so you have an income disparity that is also breaking down along racial and ethnic lines. And a couple of statistics and facts I was reading up on some studies around tipping, and in a tip-based system, studies have shown that non-white servers make less than their white peers for equal work. Were these things on your mind when you decided to eliminate tipping?
As in anything in life, if you want to make change, you have to make change in that. There's just nothing good about it. I also want to share something else. You know, when we first introduced this, the biggest question that we got from guests came from people who were my age or older. They fell into two different camps. One of the camps I had a really tough time appreciating, and that was the people that said, "How dare you take away my right to punish bad service?" And I haven't read that amendment, you know, that says you have the right to bear tips. They said, if you remove tipping, how can I be assured that your servers are actually going to be nice to me? And I would say, well, have you ever had bad service before? And they say, yeah, and I punish it every time. Well, and I go, well, then obviously the tipping system didn't prevent bad service, did it? It doesn't prevent bad service. Bad service happens. And when it happens, it's like cooks accidentally overcook steaks. I don't dock them their pay, but I will tell you one thing. It's my job to decide whether that cook's going to get a promotion or whether that cook's going to get to keep their job. And if we have a server who is only nice to people in his station, who he perceives as being someone who in 2 hours is going to give him a bigger tip, I don't want that server on my staff. I don't want a server judging you and judging the five tables in his section and saying, that's the one I'm going to be nice to because they look rich. That's the one I'm going to give really quick service to because I want to turn their table to get to someone richer.
And I can tell you, as someone who waited tables, that servers make those exact calculations.
I think so, and that's where sometimes, you know, people make racial and or gender judgments as well. So I just have not come up with a good reason. And finally, I would say that I think most people figure out what kind of tipper they are, and that's what they do all the time. If I'm a 20% tipper, I don't all of a sudden become an 18% tipper because the dessert took too long. Tipping is one of the poorest forms of staff feedback you can possibly imagine.
Coming up, my conversation with Danny Meyer continues. We'll do a lightning round where Danny runs through all the phrases the waiters in his restaurants are not allowed to say. Plus, he'll explain how he knows a person will be a great employee. And we'll talk about the impact his father's bankruptcy has had on his approach to business. Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or the podcast app, or do whatever it is you do in your podcasting app of choice to make sure you keep getting new episodes of The Sporkful. Maybe in your app it's following or favoriting. The best way to find out what it's called in your app is to do it right now while you're listening. Thanks. Now back to my conversation with Danny Meyer. If you ask Danny how he's managed to open so many successful restaurants, he'll tell you it's all about hospitality. He's really big on hospitality. He wrote the book on it, literally. His 2008 New York Times bestseller was called Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. I wanted to understand how he instills this in his staff, especially now that he owns so many restaurants. But before we got to that, it was time for a sort of lightning round. I hear you have five least favorite service-isms, or phrases often uttered by servers in restaurants. I'm going to read each one, and I want you to give me the one-sentence explanation for why you don't like it. First, least favorite service-ism. How is everything?
It's the worst question that was ever invented, because I would like to meet the person for whom everything is truly fine. Everything is a big word, and I think it's a question that's dishonest, and it always gets a dishonest answer, and I don't think you really want to know how everything is, so don't ask me.
All right, good. Number two, are you still working on that?
Unfortunately, Restaurant Speak created this ridiculous expression, are you still working on that? I spent my entire time working so I could afford to eat in your restaurant. It really wasn't work to eat it. So really what we try to do is to train our staff to actually use no words, but to make eye contact, which they should have been doing throughout the meal, and simply make a gesture with their hand toward the plate. And if people don't pick up on that, then you can say, may I? If they don't pick up on that, you can say, may I clear your plates? If they don't pick up on that, just say, are you done already?
Number three, no problem.
Well, presumably, that's in response to you saying thank you to me. And I think to answer thank you with a double negative, no problem, is I kind of feel comfortable with what I was brought up saying, which is you're welcome. It's just, it should never have been a problem.
Number four, are we enjoying our food tonight?
There's two problems with that. Number one is I was not invited to your table. And it's just ridiculous restaurant speak. Worse than we is the lady finished?
Oh, God. Where are you eating? I haven't gotten that one.
You'd be surprised.
Number five, I have a little gift here from Chef.
Two problems with that, too. You're referring to the practice which is supposed to feel nice which is to give a little amuse-bouche or a taste of something before your meal starts. But it's not a gift, and it's not from the chef. I'm the guy that paid for it. But it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. It's obviously supposed to be a gesture. It's built into your price. And probably what's even worse is that after we say a little gift from chef, we then take this thing that is about half of a bite and we tell you every ingredient and the recipe for how to make it. We tell you more about that bite than we tell you about your entree, which is actually 50 times larger.
You have pioneered a concept that you call enlightened hospitality, which is built around the idea that, you know, there's the old idea in the service industry, the customer is always right, the customer comes first. And you have said instead that you want to put your staff first and create a place where they are good to, you are good to them and they are good to each other. And if you create that, then they will in turn be good to your customers.
In service or performance, service is the technical delivery of the product. I never want to hear the word service used when what you really meant was hospitality. If we get the service right, it's only the beginning. But if we get the hospitality right, that's what makes a restaurant your favorite. And as James Beard, the late James Beard, used to say when people would ask him, what's your favorite restaurant? He had the best answer on earth. And his answer was, my favorite restaurant is the one that loves me the most.
And so how do you find people who are able to make that connection with the people
coming
to the restaurant?
We made an observation as we looked at our most successful servers. And once we made the observation, then we could name it. We could become much more intentional about hiring people who had what we started to call having a high hospitality quotient, a high HQ. In six emotional skills, they were way higher than the average person. First one is kind and optimistic. The second emotional skill is curious intelligence. Third one is work ethic. We can teach anyone how to set the table the right way, but we can't teach you how to care to do it the right way. So we're looking for that. The fourth one is empathy. The fifth one is self-awareness. And then finally, integrity. And so if we can get someone who is a really good pasta cook, that's not enough to get a job unless they have those six emotional skills. I want a cook who is happiest herself when she sees that plate come back empty.
I know you talk a lot about the importance of optimism for the people that you want working with you and for you, and you've said yourself as an entrepreneur that you need a certain amount of optimism. But I know that from reading your book that you're also motivated by other emotions. And I was especially interested to hear you talk a little bit. I know your father was an entrepreneur who dealt with a couple of bankruptcies that were pretty formative experiences for you as a young man. Can you tell me, like, what do you remember about the first time your father declared bankruptcy?
Well, my dad was in the travel business, and he was a really successful entrepreneur from the idea standpoint. He was also a great cook, and so I got those two things from him. But he tended to, unfortunately, surround himself with people not necessarily who complimented his weaknesses, but who complimented him. He needed a lot of compliments, and he overexpanded without having a team that could support him properly. And what I remember about his first bankruptcy was being probably 10, 12, 11. We all sat in the living room, and my dad, who I, you know, he was my best friend. And if you're a kid, you don't want to see your best friend be fallible and break down crying in front of the whole family. And, you know, I didn't even understand what bankruptcy meant. I just kept hearing words like lawyers and accountants and lots of tears in the family. And the impact it had on me was that's why I didn't open a second restaurant for 10 years. And in fact, I didn't open a second restaurant until 4 years after my dad died. And I had given myself permission that I wasn't my dad.
I spoke with someone who worked with you years ago at 11 Madison Park. I said, tell me about Danny Meyer. And he said, you know, he's a great guy, great sense of humor, great to work with. One thing he said that caught my interest, he said, I've never seen him out of control. Are you ever out of control?
Only when I tweet at 3 in the morning.
Where does that control come from?
Did you bring a couch with you? Because I'm thinking about, you know, this is getting a little bit, little
itchy. These are pretty plush chairs, Danny.
Yeah, this is getting a little itchy up here right now. Look, I think, first, I feel like I have this Zen quality about me where there's not too many waves that are going to knock me off my surfboard. And I love surfing. I chose to go in a business that is one wave after the next. And I obviously thrive on that, and I like it. Now, if you want to ask, you know, emotionally, why is that? How do I have this makeup? Maybe it's being the middle child in a family of three with a Republican dad and a Democratic mom, you know, during the era of Watergate and Vietnam, and constantly just wanting everything to be okay. And I've turned that into a pretty good career because I like to make things okay for people. You can take a strength, whatever your greatest strength is, if you take it too far, it's going to potentially become a weakness. And one of my strengths is I like to make people feel better. If I take that too far, it can become a weakness because I don't want to get unhappy myself if I can't make you happy. And I finally learned at Union Square Cafe many, many years ago that there are some people who are actually happy when they're unhappy. And to just let it go. If I know that I've done everything I can and you still don't want to be happy, then maybe I made you happy.
I like that. Danny, thank you so much for being
here
tonight.
Thank you,
Dan. Big hand for Danny Meyer. That does it for this week. Please make sure you subscribe or favorite or follow this podcast in your podcasting app of choice. That helps other people discover our show and make sure you will never miss an episode. Thank you. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Shoshana Gold and me. Editing help from Dan Charles. Engineering help from Ed Haber. Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. And special thanks to Teresa Weber, Jenna Farley, and all the folks at Manhattanville College for helping to make this show possible. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And this is Maureen from Ohio, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.